Hello and welcome to Presenting, a podcast where we chat about various topics related to role-playing games. I'm John Godek, and with me today is Nicole Lindrews. Welcome to the podcast.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Yeah, it's great. I've seen you on social media, and it's really exciting for me to connect with you. I've talked to Owen Casey Stevens in the past, and I'm familiar with some of your products. Actually, the last live Gen Con, I picked up some Mutants and Masterminds books, and also the Expanse role-playing game. So I'm very excited about some of the stuff you have.
Cool.
So Nicole is the Chief Operating Officer and co-founder of Green Ronin Publishing. A gaming veteran of 30 years, Nicole has previously worked for Lion Rampant, White Wolf Publishing, and Atlas Games, and also co-founded Adventures Unlimited magazine. Nicole has also volunteered on the board of directors of the Game Manufacturers Association, the Origins Awards Committee, and as the chairman of the Academy of Adventure Gaming Arts and Design. So all those sound like they're really, really cool and important, but I really don't know what any of them are except for the orange origins part. So,
I could tell you more or leave it alone.
No, actually, I'm actually curious. So what is like the Game Manufacturers Association, and then what is the Academy of Adventure Gaming Arts and Design?
So the Game Manufacturers Association was founded in the late 70s, and it has been the sole industry trade organization for game publishers and manufacturers. I did a stint on the board of directors about 15 years ago. And then I took some time off. My partner in Green Ronin, Hal Mangold, stepped up and served on the board for a while as well. And then in the last couple of years, I did another stint on the board, which was focused on expanding the membership of the Manufacturers Association to make it a full industry organization. So now there are voting member classes like for publishers and manufacturers that started it, but also for retail, game retailers, for press and conventions, and for individual people who are individual creators, because in the many years since it started, we've seen more people going out and becoming game designers and selling their games to various publishers. They work as a design house. And there wasn't really a category for that, for those people to be engaged and to take advantage of the benefits of the organization. So after a lot of really hard work, mostly by people who came before me, but I got to be on the board while, you know, when the final vote was cast last year, the membership was expanded. And in March, the big annual trade show, the Gamma Expo, will be open to everybody in the industry on all the various tiers and levels that we participate in game making and selling.
All right. Yeah, Nicole, could you talk a little bit about the Academy of Adventure Gaming Arts and Design that you were chairman of?
Sure. That is the standing committee, of the Game Manufacturers Association. And they are in charge of judging and adjudicating the votes and handing out the Origins Awards.
So the
juries for each of the categories are made up of members of the Academy, and it was one of the only ways for individual participants in the game industry to interact, because Gamma was set up where companies were members, but individual people were not. So the Academy served as a place for individuals to kind of have a hand in what was happening as far as appreciating game design and game designers who should be in the Hall of Fame and that kind of thing.
Wow. So you can, as an individual designer, you can be a member of the Academy then.
Correct. Although now that we have, I'm no longer on the board again, but while I was on the board, they did open up the membership to, and there's an individual creators category now of dues paying voting membership. So, the Academy is still going to serve, I think, as the judging body for the Origins mm-hmm. Awards. But then now individual creators can actually have a stake in the industry organization that represents the whole industry instead of just manufacturers and their retailer friends.
Well, that's good. So me as a small, I'm a freelancer, you know, freelance writer and game designer and stuff. Is there any benefit for me to join, to be a member of the Academy like that, other than that it sounds really cool?
I think that the only thing that they're doing right now is because of the bylaws changed and the structure of the organization changed, the parent organization, I think all they're doing right now with the Academy is forming juries to look at the year's Origins Awards nominees or potential nominees, coming up with a nomination list, and then being responsible for putting that out for voting. I have been advocating for individual creators to be able to join the association for a long time, for like 15 years. It was one of the things I wanted to do the first time I served on the board. So by having a creators category of membership now, many of the things that I was looking at to hopefully kind of bring the Academy of Adventure Gaming Arts and Design on for, I think will now probably be handled by the creators division of the Game Manufacturers Association.
Mm. Very neat. All right. Well, let's change gears a little bit. I was just really curious. I hadn't thought about asking those questions until I'm reading this and I said, you know what? I don't really know what these things are. And they sound kind of neat.
I'm kind of like policy wonk, so I don't want to bore anybody with the minutiae of how things are voted on in the Manufacturers Association, but I'm really excited about the changes, and hopefully we'll see a lot more individuals benefiting from things like educational seminars and mentorship and stuff. So
yeah, especially like on the business side of things, I think I'm a business professor, so I understand a lot of the business side of things, and I run into a lot of creatives that's just something that is so far from their background. They spend a lot of time trying to learn that and figure it out in the part of doing their business of designing and writing and stuff.
Right. There are a lot of people who end up kind of default running a business so that they can put their games out. But what they really want to do is design games and bring them out to people and see people playing their games and enjoying them. And that's where their reward is. Mm-hmm. And they really don't want to be running their own business. I think that that is one of the reasons that the growth of the people who work as design house, either as individuals or collaboratively, has really been a benefit for individual creators who want to do that kind of work, but who don't want to run a business. Mm-hmm, 30 years ago, you didn't have a choice. There was nobody to sell your game to. You had to publish it yourself, and in the course learn a bunch of really hard lessons about running a business.
Well, speaking of hard lessons about running a business, can you talk about the path that led you to become a game designer and publisher and co-founder of Green Ronin Publishing?
I can, sure. I was very lucky in that I lived in a college town that had two four-year private colleges, St. Olaf and Carleton in Northfield, Minnesota. Yeah. And through people that I knew in town, I got hooked up with a group of college kids, basically. They'd either just graduated or were just graduating. So there's a 4-year range in age amongst us, and they were doing their own game and they needed people to play test. And so I started helping by playing and commenting on the games. There was a point where I was playing the games like three nights a week. And I basically saw a Nicole-shaped hole in the company and I stepped in to fill it, which was funnily enough, doing all of those businessy things that they didn't want to do, like balancing the checkbook and writing back to people who sent letters and sent them to the P.O. box, because this was pre-email days. It was like the dawn of desktop publishing, and I just happened to be in with the right group of people who had access to a Macintosh and were, you know, learning how to use PageMaker and put out their own games. And so I got to come along for the ride. That led to me being one of the people who was invited down from that group in Minnesota to merge with the Wick brothers, who were publishing a magazine, White Wolf Magazine. And we joined Lion Rampant and White Wolf together and started to work from Georgia. And that resulted in Vampire the Masquerade. So I was on the ground floor of getting Vampire the Masquerade out the door and into people's hands. And, you know, we were just really, really lucky to hit at the right time with the right vibe and message. And it became popular enough that everybody who was part of that original group of people is still part of the industry. Lisa Stevens from mm-hmm. Paizo.
I've heard of her. Yes.
Yeah. One of the founders. Wow. Mark Reinhagen, who is most known for the vampire stuff, but also Jonathan Tweet. Jonathan didn't move to Georgia with everybody else, but he remained in the game industry and went on to work at Wizards of the Coast. And let's see, who else is there? Oh, John Nephew did a little stint with us. And when I got tired of living in Georgia, I wanted to go back to Minnesota. John was literally living in the house that we, the Lion Rampant kids, had vacated. He went and rented that house. And so I got on board with running Atlas Games with him for a while. Before I got married and moved to Canada, my husband was going through was going into his master's degree at University of British Columbia. So,
oh, cool.
When I moved up there, I stayed active as a freelancer, and I freelanced on I was doing Earth Dawn then, mostly Earth Dawn freelancing, I think, at that point, and some independent Ars Magica stuff. And I got together with a bunch of really great people who I'm friends with to this day in the Vancouver, British Columbia area. And there were like, 2, 4, 6, 8, 10, 12, 13 of us that joined together and started a quarterly magazine called Adventures Unlimited. And we did that. And so, you know, after all of that time, I really just kind of became I knew people in the industry. I could get freelance gigs when I wanted them. I was trying to figure out what I wanted to do, but I knew that I wanted to stay in doing games. So when I when I moved back to the States, I had actually considered doing becoming like a representative and traveling to small conventions that smaller game publishers didn't have manpower for, or that they felt weren't really, maybe wouldn't be worth their time to exhibit individually. So I went to Dragon Con that 98. Went to Dragon Con 98 with a table that had basically all my friends' stuff on it. Like, I had a friend who was doing miniatures, fantasy miniatures. So I had his stuff, and I knew a guy who is making fonts and putting them out on CDs and publishing those. And one guy had a card game, and my now husband and co owner of Green Ronin Chris Premis was one of my clients as well. His first company, Ronin Publishing, had done some stuff. He had started working at Wizards of the Coast and wasn't going to be able to rep his own company. So I took his stuff down there and repped for him. And then I met at that show, I met James Ernest of Cheapass Games. And he wanted to hire me to be his sales manager. So I did a couple of years at Cheapass Games. And then Chris wanted to, he was working in miniatures at Wizards of the Coast, and he wanted to keep his hand in role-playing stuff and saw an opportunity to do his own thing with role-playing. And so from the time he started it, I was helping out with layout and businessy, salesy stuff. And kind of since then, I've moved into the background. I don't do very much creative. I do much more project managing, and I've done sales and customer service, which I am not temperamentally fit for. So we hired a professional for that. I'm much too willing to fire people for getting on my nerves, and maybe that's not the best. There are people who are customer service guy, Dylan Templar, has been an absolute lifesaver, because he is much more willing to try to make things nice with somebody who comes in having had a bad day, raging and screaming that, you know, we're trying to rip him off or something. That kind of confrontation gets me worked up. I'm like a reactive pet that way, I guess.
No, I hear you. My wife, she is the VP of a business and has to handle a lot of difficult customers. And it's like, why don't you just tell them to F off? And so, well, no, you can't do that in the business. And so, well, can you talk a little bit more about Green Ronin Publishing? Kind of, you know, what you started off doing and how that's grown and what you're up to now?
Sure. So ironically for us, 2020 would have been, well, it still was, but it was supposed to be our celebration of 20 years in business. Mm-hmm. And we had a bunch of stuff planned. We were sponsoring things at Gen Con, and we were going to have like a big anniversary party where we invited people to come in and celebrate with us. And then pandemic. And so like not one of our celebratory things went off. So in 2021, we thought we might be able to have a little, you know, back to normal. But then we realized that that we're kind of in an extended time of strangeness. So we're just going to keep celebrating every anniversary as it comes up until we get to have that big party that we wanted to do. When the very first thing we did was a game called Orc, the role-playing game. And it is a beer and pretzels, you know, me, big dumb orc, me, M, kill you now, Crom, hate you, you know, that kind of... just kind of be, we're going to have a fight for no reason kind of fun game. Not exactly intellectually stimulating, but fun. And that released at Origins in 2020. But shortly after, we followed up by having an adventure at Gen Con when third edition D&D debuted. I think people don't really understand how suspicious the game industry was at that point. Like everybody was waiting to see if it was some sort of trick, or, you know, if there was going to be a backlash, or, you know, when there was going to be the other shoe that dropped with this thing that sounded too good to be true. And so there were very few people who wanted to go all in. There were people on the edges who were thinking of stuff and were testing it out. But it turned out that it was John Nephew at Atlas Games and Chris and I and Hal who kind of were willing to just put it all out there. And so the two of us, Atlas Games and Green Ronin, had some of the first D20 products that you could buy on the day that the new edition debuted. And so that's where people really remembered us from. Because you know, that took off a little bit. That D20 thing sold a lot of, yeah. a lot of copies, and spawned a lot of companies and made a lot of connections that are still around, you know, Wolf Bauer at Cobalt and of course, Paizo spun out of that entire thing. And, and it really, it changed a lot about the industry as it was. So all of a sudden, like, we were all kind of in this same pool. Sometimes it was kind of adversarial, but largely it was cooperative. And so we started doing things like everybody was doing whatever they could think of as fast as they could. And some of it wasn't great because it was rushed or the rules, they didn't understand the new rules properly and stuff. But at other times there were people who were like, well, I want to do a book of elves. And then somebody else would be like, well, I'm already halfway through doing a book of elves. And so there were these like rivalries that sprung up, but also people who worked together. And I'm kind of proud to say that Green Runeen tried to be in that group that was working with other people. So we created a little logo. I want to say Interlink, OGL Interlink, a voice that a little bird reminds me, OGL Interlink. And so we talked to people. For example, we put out several books that were paired with books that the guys at Paradigm Concepts were doing. They were supposed to be
that,
like,
is cool. Yeah.
You know, play well together. And we got covers that would, you know, kind of complement each other and stuff like that. Instead of being like, ha ha, I got my orc book out before you could get your orc book out. We were like, okay, well, so I'm going to do, you know, dwarves and you're going to do giants because dwarves and giants go together or whatever, you know, creative spark there was for those things. So we did just more than 100 D20 products. And after, you know, the market kind of went through some extreme changes with the changes in editions and stuff. So we were focusing more on some of our own properties, trying to create intellectual properties. And that's where you would find Mutants and Masterminds coming in. Steve Kenson, who has worked with us almost since we started, like 2002 or something, he was doing his first books for us. He had written this superhero supplement for a game that then wasn't going to come out, so he was kind of shopping for a home for it. And he brought it to us to see if we might want to do it as a D20, you know, superhero thing. And Chris was like, well, we don't have a superhero game, but if you could design a game, we'll publish the game and we'll publish your city setting. And that's how Mutants and Masterminds started development. It was originally meant to be just a supplement to a D20 supplement that would require the main, you know, Dungeon Master's Guide and Player's Handbook from regular D&D. And the more Steve worked with it, the more we were like, you know, I don't think that step is necessary. So we kind of went out on a limb and made it a standalone game that was based on the OGL. And at the time, you know, that was seen as being not necessarily in the spirit of things, I think, by some people.
Oh, kind of risky, too, I would imagine.
A little bit, yeah. And it's, you know, I'll be honest. It was 2004, and we kind of bet the company that we had a really good thing there. And thankfully, retailers and superhero fans decided that we did as well. And it's been our longest running game. It's been 20 years now, because it was 18 years when we celebrated our 20th anniversary. But what's time anymore?
yeah.
Yeah, so people knew us for D20. Then they kind of knew us for Mutants and Masterminds. And then we spun off a bunch of different systems. We got some interesting licenses. We got the license for the Game of Thrones books. It was the literary license, but it happened before the HBO series came out. So once HBO
series came out, we
benefited from that without having to license the HBO version, which would have been a lot more money. We got the DC license to do a four book series of DC DC heroes, villains, and setting. When we launched the third edition of Mutants and Masterminds, we did the Dragon Age game, which is, you know, computer game, but we did the tabletop adaptation of that, and that's where the system that is now Green Ronin's like house system, the Age system, the adventure game engine, came into being, was through that development, and has since spun off into Fantasy Age, and our Blue Rose game runs on it, our Expanse game runs on it. We've got a modern age game that has its own setting, a planar time hopping kind of setting that can be, you know, you can do almost everything that you can conceive in the modern era in that in the modern game, and it is what is going to be powering our upcoming Cthulhu Awakens game. Be powered by Age, so that's kind of what we're known for now after 22 years.
That's a lot of ground and a lot of history there to come through. You know, I've interviewed both, Wolfgang and also Jason Nelson, who's another kind of local third-party publisher. And so it's kind of neat to get you, you know, along with that as well. You know, we started, you've mentioned a couple times about how 2020 was your going to be your 20th anniversary, but the pandemic is kind of really riled things up quite a bit. You know, how do you characterize the tabletop RPG industry now, you know, especially for third-party publishers like yourself in this ongoing pandemic? How has that affected you, other than your in-person events really can't really be taking place like you had hoped?
Well, sure. That is, I mean, obviously the in-person events were a huge blow, especially for, like, Gen Con was our bread and butter, an entire probably third of my my yearly planning budget came out of our Gen Cons. So that was kind of, that made us scramble a bit. But there have been other things that have also affected and continue to affect us. We've heard it about pretty much everything, you know, supply chain. I don't know if you know Connor Alexander. He did a Kickstarter for like a native future game called Coyote and Crow. Super fantastic. And he had a printer lined up for his books, and the printer came back to him and said, "Oh yeah, we're not going to be able to get the paper to print for like 8 months. That's the best we can do." And it was supposed to be like by his schedule, you know, 12 weeks or
paper.
Whatever. Paper.
Couldn't get paper.
That's right.
Wow.
The people at Wizards, who go through, you know, far, far, far more copies of books in a year than we do, literally buy their paper in advance to make sure that they have paper to print the books on so that they can keep their schedules. So being able to even access printing has turned into this like weird, you know, roll a die, maybe you're lucky today kind of game that really isn't a lot of fun. That game is not fun.
We're in the Northwest. Don't they make paper here? I don't understand.
They do make paper here, but they don't send it to the printer that we use in Texas or wherever he is, right? And that's also a thing that so much manufacturing moved overseas. When I first started and we were doing all this, you know, tabletop, desktop publishing, we had our pick of printers. But you know, the printers that we were using have gone out of business, or they've changed, and they can only do certain types of printing. And most of the stuff that people expect today, especially if it's like hardbacks with color, printed in, you know, thousands of copies at a time, are doing printing overseas. For years, it was China. There are some other places, Eastern Europe and other places in Asia that have picked up the business. But now that, you know, supply chains are all crazy, we had a game. We did a little card game expansion where we took our Mutants Masterminds setting and we married it through a license with the people who do, with Greater Than Games, who do Sentinels of the Multiverse. So we have a version of that skinned for our fans with our characters, and it's called Sentinels of Earth Prime, and it works with their game, and it was supposed to be all super cool. And
I love Sentinels. That's neat. I didn't realize you guys were doing that. So
because it's been like 4 years because of, you know, tsunamis and like, you know, plant closures, and it was finished printing and was supposed to be shipping to us at any time, sometime last summer. And we had a production copy, and we were able to take that production copy and show people at the two conventions that we did in person last year. See, it does exist. We just have to get them from China. We still do not have them from China, although I have it on good authority that they are on United States soil, but they're not through customs, and we don't have them to give to people even yet. It's just been so chaotic that way. So I think a lot of lot of us fell back on things like PDF or print on demand that could be localized, so that we didn't have to worry about shipping. If you do print on demand, like with Lulu, I guess you can have it printed in Europe and shipped to you. If you live in Europe, you don't have to have it shipped from the United States, and benefits like that. So I think that's how a lot of us adjusted. A lot of PDF sales definitely went with electronic sales to fill the gap. Our 2022 we're still trying to release backed up product that has just kind of all been out there in various stages of getting finished and getting back into our hands for the last year and a half. So 2022 will be the year where we finally get out the things we thought we were going to put out in 2020. It's a little nerve-wracking, I'm sure.
No, that's crazy. That's crazy. Well, you know, kind of in light of all this stuff that's happened, how do you think the industry will evolve in kind of in reaction to a lot of these changes? Do you think there'll be a lot more domestic production? Do you think smaller businesses will try to hoard or collect the paper ahead of time, like the big businesses, or just go straight print on demand or PDF stuff?
Well, I think that there's no denying that that electronic product is going to be really strong, because you just take that whole printing, shipping unknown out of it. I think we all saw, you know, the explosion of virtual tabletops in pandemic really took off. I had never done any gaming. I know, you know, there were people who were just doing games over Discord, just, you know, talking back and forth. There wasn't even any die rolling or anything. All the way up to, you know, the various tabletop simulators and, you know, with their dynamic lighting and tokens and all this stuff. It was completely something that I did not dabble in, because I liked, one of the reasons I liked gaming is to have people over at my house and serve dinner and sit around the table together, you know, munching chips and moving miniatures. But when we couldn't do that, you know, we had to adapt. And so now I've got a little more under my belt personally, playing in some really, you know, really nice, enjoyable, spirit lifting games through virtual tabletops. I think that is definitely a place where people can focus, especially if they're trying to get into the industry. I think that they might as well try to establish themselves in the electronic PDF market or in things like virtual tabletop unless things calm down with supply chains and mm-hmm. so on. Mm-hmm. I don't think that those things will lose any of their appeal. They're certainly going to be here to stay. So we're certainly looking at it for sure. Mm-hmm.
So there are a lot of tabletop RPG companies in the Seattle area. Do you all like play games with the competition? I'm kind of curious, like actual, you know, tabletop role-playing games with them?
Yeah, we do. It's kind of funny, isn't it? You would think that we would be all adversarial, like we're fighting over, you know, the same eyes or something. But you know, so many of us do things that are just kind of personally fulfilling and not really it's our personal interest, right? So again, I'm going to go with Coyote and Crow, for example. Mm-hmm. Like, nobody was bringing out that game until Connor said, you know, we really need this game and I'm going to do it. And now that area, he got to blaze that trail. Mm-hmm. And if other people decide that they want to do similar sorts of personal projects, that's not going to impact my ability to, sell my Mutants and Masterminds games to the people who like Mutants and Masterminds, who want mm-hmm. my superhero stuff, or the people who are fans of one of the licenses that we hold. And so I think, you know, we all recognize that the Pathfinder fans are loyal to their game. And so we don't mm-hmm. need it. We're not really fighting for the same people. It's not like this adversarial thing. We're all kind of at a level where we're happy to be able to be in this business and mm-hmm. happy that our friends are also able to be in this business. Mm-hmm. That's always how I've seen it anyway. I mean, maybe I'm lucky that way, but I certainly have sat down and played games with all sorts of game designers and people who run companies in the area and attended conventions, you know, that we all see each other at. And so, like, in fact, I will say that a lot of people from early in the D20 era, a lot of people, we all worked together. Wolf Bauer wrote one of the first books that we did, mm-hmm. Jade Dragons and Hungry Ghosts, that took this, like, you know, kind of Asian mythology stuff and made it for D20. And we published that before Kobold existed. The same with Eric Mona. Eric Mona wrote with a couple of other guys, wrote a superhero book for Mutants and Masterminds. And Rodney Thompson has worked with us. Of course, Owen works with us. Owen has worked with us on and off. Even when he was working at Paizo, I was like, okay, well, I want to pay you to be a consultant because you are a very smart man. And, mm-hmm. and I want to hear what you have to say about these ideas that we're considering, because we're only going to be better for having consulted you. So really super fortunate to have that kind of relationship with Owen over the years. I feel like we're all really pretty friendly and close knit for the most part.
Yeah, I had interviewed Jeff Grubb, and he mentioned he had a standing game with a bunch of people and, you know, at other companies. And I thought that's got to be kind of cool, you know, to
sure.
do that sort of
yeah.
thing.
Yeah, I mean, I don't see Monty and Shanna anymore, but they briefly lived one light rail stop up from my house. So we'd occasionally run into them in the neighborhood, you know, we'd both be shopping for bread at the same time or whatever.
Very cool.
Yeah. It's just, I don't know. It's my family. It's one of the reasons that I haven't left for a more lucrative job doing something else. You know, I could be the COO of the city of Seattle, according to LinkedIn. They wanted to sell me that job.
I wouldn't want that job.
No, sorry. I wouldn't either. You couldn't pay me enough.
Yeah. They try to sell me on lots of jobs. I like my cushy academic job. It's not real work. That's
all. So some of the very best people in the world work in the game industry, and I have been fortunate to know them, and I haven't been able I've never come to the conclusion that it's not worth being a part of that community. So
neat. So do you have any advice for people interested in doing writing or even starting a publisher, self-publishing RPGs, getting into the industry? And in particular, what if they want to write for Green Ronin? Do you have a way for them to kind of get their foot in the door?
So I absolutely encourage people to use the various creator content programs that have been started by some of the publishers. I think it's, I think the White Wolf properties are all, there's some sort of creator content program with that. I might be wrong about that, but I think there is. There's the GM's Guild for D&D specific stuff. We actually have some very small programs for our couple of lines. People who wanted to have a free license to make Mutants and Masterminds compatible stuff have been able to do that. Lewis Porter Jr. is one of the people who really did just a lot of things for Mutants and Masterminds under that program. And I'm drawing a blank on some of the other names, which I feel really bad about. But there are people who've been, for years publishing stuff, putting it up as PDFs on DriveThru or something like that, supporting other people's main products. And that's a way to get noticed, to show that you can put together a project or that, that you understand what's necessary to make the content appealing, like a good adventure or whatever. One of the things, there's also all the itch games, the indie side. So I really think that is a place that has a lot of opportunities for people who want to do more personal kind of, maybe I don't want to say non-commercial, because obviously they're trying to sell their games as well, but they're really more interested in taking some things that maybe aren't as mainstream and putting them out that way. Those are excellent ways to get started. It's also really possible to find partnership ideas with companies after you have participated in something like a creator content program. We have a creator content program for the Age system and for the Chronicle system, which is the system that ran the Song of Ice and Fire, which is our Game of Thrones line. So we genericized that system, put it out as Sword Chronicle, and now you can do you can put stuff up as part of our creative content program through DriveThru, and those are places where people can kind of prove their chops and prove that they've got. We're really struggling actually to find people who can write at length. That seems to be a challenge. I think the old school designers like Ray Wininger and John Nephew, who were like in high school and college and were freelancing writing D&D adventures, were kind of a different generational expectation, where you're expected to be able to write 2,000 words a day, or however many thousand words a day to meet this deadline where they're going to give you a 10 to 15,000 word, project or 30,000 words even. And we're finding that, that there are some really talented people who can't write at length. And so sometimes that means that a book gets chopped up into little pieces. That means there's a lot of opportunities for a new person to come in and take a little section and show that they can do the work. But But one of the ways to stand out in that situation is to be the person who can actually sit down and do the long form work and can be trusted to handle their whole 15,000 words or 30,000 words and not just like a 5,000 or 2,000 word handover. They're kind of different. It's like, you know, writing a novel or writing a magazine article, right? Mm-hmm. So one of the ways to get in to try to make a name is to start working on some of those smaller things. But if you really want to like establish yourself as a go-to for people to get work, I think working on those long form chops will really help you stand out.
Mm-hmm. No, that's interesting. You know, I my freelance work typically has been with Paizo. I've done some for Legendary and also Evil Robot Games. And I know a lot of people that would love to do 10 to 15,000 words for different projects. So, you know, we can talk offline. I can point to you to a whole bunch of them if you're looking for some.
But. Well, there's also like the, you know, in our case, unfortunately, there's sometimes like familiarity with the IP that gets
right,
in.
Right. That's probably the biggest issue there. Yeah.
Sure.
Yeah.
I'm thinking, but for somebody like for the Paizo sort of thing where they've got a lot of content and are looking for people, that's probably where people are going to learn, right? They're going to learn their D&D to hopefully get in with the large D&D crowd or the Paizo people. Mm-hmm. Greener needs a little more, a little smaller and specific, but absolutely. Mm-hmm. If you want to learn threefold and write a bunch of modern age stuff, let me know.
Well, Mutants and Masterminds, that's what I'm interested in. In fact, I was going to ask you, you know, you mentioned partnerships. So I have the Superpowered Bestiary that was put out by Rogue Genius Games.
Oh,
so,
yeah? I know those guys.
So how was that done? Was that under like an OGL type of license with you? Or was that done in partnership or what?
That is open license. Mm-hmm. Yep.
Okay. Yeah, I was just because I do see that you're branding on it as well.
Yep.
So yeah. I like my local group. That's we were kicking around. We're starting, you know, a new set of games with one particular group, and that's the one I'm pushing is Mutants and Masterminds because several of them have the books already, and so that's where I'm hoping we're gonna go. So yeah, if there's something you need, I'm gonna be brushing up on that here in the near future.
Excellent. Yeah. Well, you know, Mutants and Masterminds is our bread and butter. We have a Patreon for it for people mm-hmm. who really want to like get up close and personal with Crystal, who's the line developer.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. Crystal Fraser, formerly of Paizo, mm-hmm. and Steve Kenson, the originator, mm-hmm. and Alex Thomas, who is assistant. We've got an assistant developer even. Hmm. We're growing, sort of.
You have a lot of offerings. I was looking through for the various adventures, and it's like there's a lot there.
The Patreon gives them a place to get to know people and to make special requests, and mm-hmm. and that's been growing over the last year. We started that during the pandemic, and that took off because you know, we didn't have the in-person conventions for fans to interact with.
Right.
With us. And then we've got a streaming program on Mondays, Mutants and Masterminds Monday. Mm-hmm. And Steve, Crystal, Alex, and Troy, in some combination of those people, do that pretty much every Monday. I think it's been through the entire pandemic. We've got that as another place to kind of brainstorm some stuff. I think Stan Brown mm-hmm. attends those and then
yeah.
uses that to do a, you know, to do the occasional cartoon as inspiration.
Right.
And so that's definitely a place to like kind of hang out and go, well, it sounds like people really want some super pets or whatever. Maybe give you some ideas.
Neat. Yeah. So what's next for both Nicole and Green Ronin? You have any cool stuff coming down the road that you want to talk about or can plug or can hint about even?
Sure. Well, so we have a Kickstarter that's going to launch in mid-February for a Cthulhu based.
You were talking about that game. Yeah.
It is. It focuses on the weird century. The setting is the weird century, and it's basically the 1920s to the 2020s. It's going to cover that time period, with the idea that a bunch of the source material, like the original Lovecraft stories and stuff that spun out of that, are both real and also lies or inaccurate, or we're playing with the existing mythos and kind of bringing it into the different decades. So there's a little advanced thing that I can tell you, is that I particularly have a fondness for a Cthulhu inspired band, The Darkest of the Hillside Thickets. And the lead singer is also an artist who has done a lot of work for Green Ronin over the last 20 years, and was really one of our go-to guys at the beginning of our company. And so we have very friendly relations. And one of their songs is inspired by a Lovecraft story, and it's about some guys who, like, they go out in the desert and they end up in they're looking for Yig and they end up in a snake pit and whatever. I was just like, the lyrics of that are so fun, and Torin sings it in this kind of like Elvis-y put on style that's really fun. And I was like, okay, so with the weird century, we could totally do that. We could have an adventure that is, this group of guys who have a 12-pack and a Chevy pickup truck, and they're going to go out and they're going to talk to people, and, they're going to get kind of messed up, and they're going to wander around and have these experiences. And maybe one of them's a little insane now, or a little different. He's been changed by the experience. And that was a run-in with some old ones. And, it's not necessarily things that people have already seen, kind of take it in a different fun direction. So my preference is to try to lure Torin to do an actual play of an adventure based on the song that his Cthulhu-inspired band did.
Wow.
That's how my brain works. That sounds super fun to me.
Yes, that's must watch streaming right there.
So you'll know if I got my way, I guess, in a couple of months. If you see that happen, I've got my way.
Very cool.
We also
have
a license for N.K. Jemisin's The Fifth Season. She won back-to-back awards for her sci-fi books, and it is a really different and cool setting that is not the sort of thing we've dabbled in before. And so I'm really excited. We've got a really diverse crew working on it, and it's going to use some of the cool base building, covenant building, community building mechanics that that we've been designing over the years. So that got delayed again because of the pandemic, but I hope to see that getting more attention in the late summer or the fall this year.
Very nice, very nice. Well, Nicole, thanks so much for joining us on the podcast today. It's been great to have a chance to get it to chat with you and learn more about, all the awesome things you've done throughout your career. And
I'm just looking
Green
at
Ronin.
The time, and I have a talker, so you got. I'm sorry.
No,
I've
this is
up.
Awesome. No, this is great. Well, thanks again. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me.